Blog Talk Radio.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live don't concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live don't concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word.
Any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussyfooting, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfucker, upmade me out of self-righteous hatred. And now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix, a suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, they'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, a.k.a. Mr. Top Shelf himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness. Ever since the Declaration of Independence, we've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years, they're prejudiced. Foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News on this 15th day of January 2013, the year 2013. Welcome back to Your World News, and thank you for all of you who have continued to join and support Your World News just by simply tuning in and spreading the word about the information that this this program aims to disseminate to the masses of oppressed people, not just in the U.S., but wherever they may be found in the globe. This is the anniversary of the birth date of Dr. Martin Luther King. In this program, we will be deconstructing some of the lesser known, the cleverly lesser known aspects of this man's life. And I say cleverly lesser known because within the U.S., whether it's the mainstream media, the corporate media, obviously, or if it's government, government officials, so-called politicians, you know, so-called leaders, community leaders, educators, whether it's in the university or if it's, in most elementary, middle schools and high schools, they completely get it wrong. Some of them purposely obfuscate and marginalize various important aspects of Dr. King's life and his work, which is his legacy. They purposely do that to take the attention away from the fact that Dr. King's work and his legacy and what he was working on is just as relevant today in 2013 as it was in 1968 when he was killed, in 1967, 1966. It's just as relevant today. And as long as we continue to allow ourselves to be programmed to think that Martin Luther King was killed in 1963. And they may not say that, but all the implications because they don't mention his work that he did from 63 until 68. They mention very little of that work, and they try to hone in on, you know, August 28th, 1963, the March on Washington, and even within that speech, just focusing on one little soundbite, you know, the content of a character and the color of your skin. They hone in on that, and they lock in on that. They don't talk about his anti-capitalist work. They don't talk about the fact that when he was assassinated, that he had strong socialist leanings. They don't talk about that he was opposed to the military-industrial complex, and yes, he was opposed to the Vietnam War. You can't be opposed to the military-industrial complex without being opposed to your America's wars. They don't talk about any of that stuff. They don't talk about his opposition, to white supremacy and so forth. And so we're gonna, because not on our watch, not on Your World News' watch, are we gonna allow this revolutionary man to be posthumously assassinated, to have his character assassinated, by those folks that are aiming to do that. We're gonna deconstruct that. We're gonna compare and contrast. And listen, I don't aim as the host of this show. I don't aim to have to just needlessly bring up Barack Obama's name within the context of Dr. King. But because so many people out there, quick to make a buck, have no historical reference or perspective, allow themselves to see a connection between Dr. King and Barack Obama by way of pictures, revisionist history pictures and revisionist history T-shirts that people wear with his face juxtaposed next to Dr. King. And even some, I mean, to take a step further, some actually have T-shirts and pictures that have Dr. King and Malcolm X's picture on the outside flanks with Obama's picture right in the middle. I mean, it's repugnant to the highest degree. And so, yes, we're also going to compare and contrast. There's very little comparison besides skin color, but we're going to contrast the life and work of Dr. King and that of the warmonger that is currently occupying 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in 2013, and that is none other than Barack Hussein Obama. So we're gonna cover a gamut of things, and so. I'm not flying this revolutionary plane, this plane, that is aimed towards, revolution and liberation is aimed towards social justice. I'm not flying this plane solo today, no pun intended. I'm joined, in studio by two student correspondents, Tim Bottoff-Lynchen, as well as Sankara Kasanji, and also joined on the line by our Midwest correspondent, Euro News correspondent, that's Peter Fowler. And so, with seniority, I will let each of these individuals, say their name and just tell our listeners why it's so important for you to do this show today, and what Dr. King's life means to you in 2013, and we'll start with Peter Fowler joining us from Michigan. Peter, can you hear me? Now you can hear me.
Yeah, good to be with you, brother. Tim Sankara, greetings to all of you. And I'm excited today, Solomon. I'm always excited to do this show with you. It's always exciting and challenging to fly this revolutionary flight. And today especially because it's what would have been the 84th anniversary of Martin Luther King's birthday. And I have been a lifelong student of Martin Luther King Jr., his life, his legacy, his program, his philosophy, and his ethics. I consider myself a critical scholar in the area of Kingian philosophy and ethics. And I always appreciate the opportunity to talk about that life and that legacy of Martin Luther King because, as you have said at the outset of the show, that memory and that legacy have been so perverted and by the mainstream media and by the culture makers of America. And what we've been seeing, like you said so well, Martin Luther King, we could say that he was killed in 1963 in terms of the way his memory, his life, and his legacy are remembered. And what we've seen for the last 45 years is a annual murder of the memory of Martin Luther King. Every year around this time in cities around the country, there are various MLK celebrations, and always, you're going to hear excerpts from the I Have a Dream speech on the March on Washington. People are going to get together and sing We Shall Overcome, and there's going to be all those warm and fuzzy feelings and those activities that make us, you know, feel like Martin Luther King was just a big huggable teddy bear, and that what he was about was, you know, everybody just sitting down together at the table of brotherhood and we might even use Rodney King, obviously no relation to Martin, but what Rodney King said several decades later was, you know, can't we all just get along? Well, Martin King was about much more than that, so much more than that. And so to have his memory murdered, or to use your terms, to see him posthumously assassinated on an annual basis, it really stirs my soul and makes me angry and stirs up some indignation in me. So I'm excited to do the show today to try to use this as a corrective to talk about the real Martin Luther King Jr., talk about the real philosophy and the real program, the radical program, the revolutionary program that was the program of Martin Luther King Jr., and particularly where he stood after 1963, particularly after 1965, and especially that last year of his life, starting in April of 1967, which we know was ushered in with that famous speech about how and why he opposed the war in Vietnam. So let's get at it today, and let's talk about who the real King was, and who the real King is, and why he's relevant today, because you're so right. The life and legacy of King is more than relevant for today, and I think we need King now just as much as we ever did as a country. So let's get to it.
Right on. Sankara?
Yeah, so glad to have you with us here today. And I'm just glad to be here, January, to commemorate not only Martin Luther King's birthday, but also his work and what he stood for. I know he stood for a lot of things, one of them being nonviolent resistance. But I think it's very important for us to put that into context, especially, with what's going on today in America and, you know, U.S. foreign policy, and why his message of nonviolence is a message that not only resonates with us here in the United States, but also wanted to resonate abroad in terms of U.S. foreign policy. So on that note, I'm going to go ahead and pass it to Tim. Do you want to elaborate?
Yes, great to be on the show with all of you. To me, this show is a great opportunity to just expose the hypocrisy that is fed to the American public about Dr. King, about his history and how he's paraded nowadays with the monument being built in D.C., sponsored by donors that Martin Luther King would be completely opposed to, and I'm sure we'll get into that, how we have streets named after him and all that, when at the same time, right now, Obama has just recently planned on sending troops, U.S. troops, to 35 African countries where wealth and income inequality is so extreme to this day. All things that Martin Luther King would strongly disapprove of. So I think this show is going to give us a great speaking round to just kind of go into those hypocrisies and highlight the true work that he did in his lifetime.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. And yeah, it's very instructive. We're going to start off with a soundbite that, you know, we're definitely going to get into soundbites from Dr. King, but I just want to also, like, you know, before I play something, I want to read to folks something that came from that should be even more famous speech on April 4th, 1967 at Riverside Baptist Church in New York City, his Beyond Vietnam, you know, speech, Breaking the Silence. And, you know, to touch on, you know, he came to a crossroads where he looked at nonviolence, and he was somebody that was a practitioner of nonviolence, but he also looked at the U.S., you know, social constructs for what it is, a very violent society. I mean, as we know, he said, you know, my own government is the greatest purveyor of violence on the face of the earth, and, you know, in 2013, nothing has changed. The U.S. is even more violent. The U.S. is engaged in even more wars and even more proxy wars than it was in 1967. And so that's instructive to note, take note. But he said this. He said, you know, I quote, "My third reason moves to an even deeper level of awareness, for it grows out of my experience in the ghettos of the North over the last 3 years, especially the last 3 summers. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightfully so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence." And when he says our violence, make no bones about it. And I would just, you know, I mean, who am I to correct Dr. King? But, you know, when he says our violence, he's talking about the violence of the United States government. You know, it's violence that he was fighting against. You know, it's violence that many of us have want nothing to do with. But it's oftentimes violence done in our name because our tax dollars help finance that. You know, and he finishes just by simply saying, "I cannot be silent." That's just one of the a paragraph from that brilliant speech, that moving speech. And I want to say this, that we talk about this all the time. It's very important for us to compare and to contrast that of Dr. King and his practices and his philosophies and his ideologies with that of Barack Obama, because Obama is unwarrantedly compared to Dr. King. There is no comparison when it comes to their philosophies and their ideologies. The fact that Obama is a warmonger who has taken, you know, so has killed, you know, countless innocent civilians by way of wars that he is orchestrating on the U.S.'s theater of war, the global theater of war, where the U.S. seems to have no boundaries in which it is able to reach, the capacity where we see U.S. military bases, you know, upwards of 1,000 military bases in over 140 different countries, that kind of presence. And the U.S. now, through Obama's approval and orchestration, expanding the role of AFRICOM into now 35 African nations militarily. So the U.S. is coming in there with that hard power, you know, to go in there under the guise that, oh, we're fighting terrorism, and so therefore let us come in here and we can help quell and put down, you know, those radical aspects of your within your continent and in your individual countries, and to put that down and to use our military presence, the most powerful military in the world, to do that. That is very clever of the U.S. because when the time comes and it comes time for them to continue, it's not like it's a new thing. They've been doing this, but when it comes time for them to further strategically place their greasy, bloody hands all over Africa's resources, and to even control them more so, they have the military there to back them up to do it. Okay. AFRICOM started in 2007 under Bush and has been expanded by Barack Obama. You know, headquarters have mostly been in Stuttgart, but now, you know, the AFRICOM finds itself in places like Djibouti and the last bombing of Libya and the taking out of Muammar Gaddafi. You know, the brutal murder of Muammar Gaddafi, and a man who was embracing the legacy of a Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, a Sajifo Kwame Nkrumah, who believed in a United States of Africa. You know, Gaddafi embraced that and was working towards that with the satellite systems, making, you know, trying to work towards having Africa dependent on each other and not Western, you know, Western powers. That was one of the major reasons why, you know, he had to be, you know, from the perspective of the Western devils, had to be killed, and that's exactly what they set out to do, you know, and the list goes on and on in terms of what Gaddafi was aiming to do with the gold dinar and making sure that, you know, that their oil was only, you know, tradable through gold and so forth, the satellite system of the United States of Africa. I mean, we can go on and on, and so Obama goes in there and starts the bombing and puts out this lies. It's blatant lies. Folks that are listening right now that bought that, you were lied to. And so when you continue to defend him, you are defending the man who threw at you a rack of bold-faced lies, blatant out-and-out devilish lies. And I say devilish lies because they're not just innocent lies, like, oh, no, I didn't take your cookie. No, these were lies that were used to take innocent lives off of this planet. You know, 50,000 lives later, you know, 50,000 Libyans have been killed, and this country is embroiled in a civil war that no one in the U.S. is talking about, at least not in the corporate media, because mission accomplished. F them. F those Africans, man. They're on their own. Mission accomplished. Oil fields, you know, are all but privatized now, in the control of the likes of French, and therefore in the control of the hands of the West. So this is all what we need to examine. We need to examine, and this is what, if Dr. King was the same man in 1968, if he had not been killed, if he was the same man in 2013 that he was in 1968, we know that he would oppose Barack Obama. He would oppose he would have opposed George Bush before that. He would have opposed U.S. military aggression and imperialism. He would oppose that. He would oppose Barack Obama bailing out the banks by the tune of $12.8 trillion plus dollars. He would want that, you know, that money to be used to bail out the people who are slated to lose their homes, the millions and millions and millions of people who now have lost their homes by way of foreclosure, by way of the unscrupulous and downright evil, you know, capitalist dealings of banks that got bailed out by the tune of $12 trillion. So he would be against all those things and more. And so we're gonna examine that. And so we're gonna start off with this clip that was put out by Brother Glenn Ford last year on Black Agenda Report, and that will kind of get the ground running. And of course, yes, we have some important and instructive takes, because no one speaks on behalf of Dr. King better than himself. So we have some takes from the Beyond Vietnam speech, and we're going to get into that. And we have some other things to be put into deeper context. We, you know, Tim mentioned the monument. We're going to break that down, the monument, some of the sponsors. Dr. King, I do not think, you know, I will just put my opinion out there. I do not think that he would have supported this monument that was built in his honor if he was aware that monument was built using dollars that came from uber capitalist outfits as well as corporations that have money squarely invested in the military industrial complex. So therefore they have money squarely invested in war profiteering. So that is important to know, and that's why they had two warmongers kick it off with Joe Biden and Barack Obama, so-called christening the monument. And I've been down there. I've been to that monument, and nowhere on that wall is there anything from that speech that I just gave you. So, of course, the programming, the mass programming on countless obsequious, mindless Americans goes on. They will go down there and visit, and nowhere on that wall will they even have to raise the question, because nowhere etched in granite on that wall is anything about the U.S. being the greatest purveyor of violence in the face of Earth. No, nothing mentioning, you know, the three triplets that he spoke of evil in America, racism, excessive materialism, the military-industrial complex. Nowhere on any of the walls near his monument is that. But they have some carefully thought out of context quotes on that wall from him. And so let's go to Glenn Ford, and then we'll get this thing kicked off. And I just want to remind folks, if you want to call in, the call-in number is 347-945-5191. Once again, that's 347-945-5191. If you have any questions or comments regarding Dr. King and the present-day hyper-violent society that we find ourselves in, you know, please do so, call in. This is Glenn Ford, Last Year.
Every year, African Americans pay respect to Dr. Martin Luther King on the anniversaries of his birth and death. Since 2009, however, these occasions have been put to the service of a revisionist and essentially obscene narrative that portrays the great triumphs and sacrifices of the Black Freedom Movement in general and Dr. King's life work in particular as mere preludes to the ascension of Barack Obama to the White House 4 decades later. This narrative finds expression in the fast buck language of T-shirts that Photoshop Dr. King shaking hands with Obama, a digital miracle achieved by erasing Malcolm X from the actual photo, a huckster's trick that amounts to a kind of political assassination of both Malcolm and Martin, and of Black history. We hear the twisted narrative in the popular post-2009 rhyme, "Rosa sat so Martin can walk, Martin walked so Obama could run, Obama ran so our children can fly." What the rhymer is saying is that Rosa Parks and Dr. King and a whole people in motion, all the sacrificing, dying, theoretical agonizing, political strategizing, and sometimes sheer terror of the struggle, were simply a prelude to Barack Obama's inaugural ball. Dr. King's and Malcolm's lives and thousands of others were snuffed out so that one day we would have those pretty pictures of Barack and his family in the executive mansion. What the revisionist narrative and the little poem really mean is that the whole of Black history has been a series of supporting acts leading up to the main event, the first Black U.S. presidency. Of course, if that really were true, then we would already have arrived at the end of Black politics and history. Ironically, this is what Black people's worst enemies would also like you to believe. Once you've bought into the revised history of Black people from Rosa Parks to the present, once all of the players from the past have been aligned in ways that make Obama inevitable, it becomes all but impossible not to believe that these dead ancestors would enthusiastically support the first Black president. especially Dr. King, the most widely revered ancestor. However, we knew Dr. King. He is probably our most documented and self-documented black leader. His words, his writings, his life testify to the certainty that Dr. King would oppose the Obama administration's foreign and domestic policies, just as he broke with the much more liberal President Lyndon Baines Johnson. Dr. King would see clearly the giant triplets, as he called them, at work in this administration: racism, extreme materialism, and militarism. It is an administration bankrolled by and in service of Wall Street, the most extreme materialism. Obama has expanded the theaters and technologies of war and claimed the right to determine who shall be killed anywhere on the planet, militarism at its worst. And Obama is so intent on protecting white supremacy and privilege, he pretends it doesn't exist. That is some deep racism. Dr. King, like anybody else, would like to be remembered for his actual battles and beliefs. But you can't celebrate Obama and celebrate Dr. King at the same time. And so the Obamites revise history and put a gag on Dr. King so that he can't denounce Obama as a warmonger from the grave. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Peter, I'll let you take a stab at that first. Sorry.
But, you know, Glenn is always right on point, you know, and he speaks well for himself, obviously. But just to follow up on a couple of his main points, because they are so salient, that one thing, you know, Glenn started off that piece by putting MLK in the context of the broader movement. And that's something else that we need to be mindful of, especially as we move forward, that we're not just celebrating Martin Luther King Jr., that Martin Luther King Jr. didn't exist in a vacuum. It wasn't just about Martin Luther King Jr., but it was the fact that he was in the thick of and often was the face of the civil rights movement in the United States, that he was in the embodiment of a wider movement for liberation, the movement for black liberation and the movement for the liberation of the disenfranchised in this country and globally. Let's keep that in mind, too. But Glenn does well by reminding us of that, and so we need to also have that as our framework as we celebrate King today, and as we revise his authentic legacy. That King was in fact the reason we know of King is because of the movement of which he was a part. So we need to be mindful of that, and also this revisionist narrative that Glenn talks about is something else that. It really troubles me, particularly since the coming of the age of Obama. All right, going back to 2008, when Obama kind of burst on the scene as a candidate for president, and obviously since his election. But it has, you know, the comparison. There really is no comparison. I don't even want to use the word comparison when we talk about King and Obama. Let's use the word contrast, because the contrast are sharp and distinct and real, and the comparisons are very shallow. In fact, the comparisons basically stop with the colors of their skins, all right? But their consciousness and their commitments couldn't be further apart. They are diametrically opposed, and it pains me to see Americans, particularly black Americans, make the connections between Martin Luther King Jr. and Barack Obama the way Glenn Ford just articulated it. Because Martin Luther King wouldn't be further away from the positions that Barack Obama takes today. So we need to revise the legacy and the memory of Martin Luther King to its authenticity in order to critique Barack Obama and his presidency, because people have been hoodwinked, people have been bamboozled, all right, and continue to be fooled by the way the MLK legacy is misremembered and marketed and sanitized so that it can become acceptable. And all of a sudden, through this process, we have Martin Luther King shaking hands with Barack Obama and people thinking that Barack Obama is the ultimate fruit of the seeds that were planted by Martin Luther King. When in fact, Martin Luther King Yeah, certainly he did plant some seeds, but Martin Luther King, it didn't start with Martin Luther King. The movement for liberation didn't start with Martin Luther King. It didn't start with Rosa Parks. It goes back centuries. It goes back to the beginning of when Africans were dragged to the shores of this country. And so Martin Luther King stood in a long, long legacy of a struggle for liberation and a struggle for freedom and a struggle for justice. And so he is in that continuum, whereas Barack Obama clearly is not. Barack Obama clearly is not in the continuum of the struggle for liberation of not just black people in this country, but of disenfranchised and poor people around the world. He is not part of the continuum of the Rosa Parks and the Martin Kings and the Frederick Douglasses and the Nat Turners and the Denmark Vases that are the highlights of the black liberation struggle in this country and the human struggle for liberation. Barack Obama is diametrically opposed to their values, to their ethics, and to their goals. And we see that every day of his presidency. We see he has a kill list. We see that he authorizes drone strikes that kill innocent people in foreign countries. And so, you know, as Sankara had said earlier, you know, the relation to the foreign policy that existed in 1967 when King came out in opposition to the war on the Vietnamese people is relevant to the foreign policy that exists today in 2013 as our melanic president and launches wars around the globe. And as Tim highlighted earlier, and I'm glad he brought that up, it's our black president who is sending American military troops into 35 more countries on the continent of Africa. They're already in several. Now he's sending them into 35 more. So we see that Barack Obama stands outside of that continuity of consciousness for black liberation and for human liberation that Martin Luther King embodies so strongly. So the comparisons don't exist. The contrasts couldn't be more clear, Solomon.
That's right. That's right. And before I get Tim and Sankara's take, I think we have a caller on line one to see if you're just listening in or if you have a comment. Caller, you're on the air. Do you have a comment on the program right now on Dr. King? Can you hear me? All right, perhaps you're just listening in. Tim, let's go with you.
I think Glenn Ford put it right to the point. He basically outlined how Martin Luther King was known for his great speeches and his how vocal he was on institutional racism, inequality, and these issues. Whereas Obama, who is today, as we know, frequently compared to Dr. King as if they had any strong similarities, he has never taken a stance on racism, institutional racism, inequality, and doesn't even mention them in his speeches. He supports the very enforcers of inequality and of institutional racism. He has a strong alliance with Israel, you know, an apartheid state, and the Zionists that run it. He has boycotted repeatedly the World Conference on Racism because of his alliance with Israel, and is a strong component of an endorser of the war on drugs, which is extremely exacerbating the problem of the prison industrial complex and institutional racism in this country. So Obama and Martin Luther King shouldn't even come up in the same sentence together, since they are so far apart when it comes to what they stand for and what Martin Luther King stood for.
That's right. Sankara, you have anything you want to chime in?
Yeah, so I think that obviously in light of all this evidence, it's pretty clear, or should be pretty clear to most listeners, that in terms of foreign policy, there's no comparison between you know, the ideology of Dr. Martin Luther King and that of Barack Obama. We talk about, you know, military spending, the continuation of AFRICOM, the invasion of Libya, the support of Israel, you know, drone strikes, and the list goes on. But some people will try to, some Obamaites will try to, you know, sidestep that by focusing on his domestic policy. But even in that sense, we can't, there's no comparison. And we talk about NDAA, you know, which is just a continuation of the Patriot Act. And also, I may have heard pretty recently people bringing up his tabling of legislation to eliminate fully automatic weapons by the recent shooting as a proof of his stance against violence. And I would counter that by saying it's really just another, you know, smoke and mirrors type of theatrics, and ignores the root of the problem, which is just a very violent society. And in light of all of his foreign policy, I don't really think that, you know, even this gesture really does, you know, us any justice in that sense. So.
Right.
St. Karin, I just wanted to thank you for bringing up the NDAA, because the ironic thing is, if Martin Luther King was alive today, most likely he would fall victim to the very policy that Barack Obama has introduced with the NDAA, and may right now be indefinitely detained without trial, evidence, or whatsoever. So the whole idea that the U.S. embraced Martin Luther King while he was alive is a lie, because he was subject to the COINTELPRO program by the FBI and was a target which was to be eliminated according to the U.S. government.
That's right. Peter, I know you have something you wanted to chime in on and contrast.
Yeah, just in addition to some of the contrasts we've already articulated between Martin Luther King and Barack Obama, you know, we recognize the fact that King opposed violence and war, while Obama embraces violence and war, that King spoke out for the poor and for Black Americans, while Barack Obama remains conspicuously silent. The one thing I want to point out, and just again as a framework as we move forward, is that over the career of Martin Luther King, which, you know, we can go back to the Rosa Parks. We mentioned Rosa Parks. We can go back to the bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama, that started in 1955. And if we look at Martin Luther King coming onto the scene in December of 1955, up until he was taken out in an untimely fashion by the state in 1968, it's a very short career, about 13 years or so. But over that career, particularly starting in the second half of 1963, Martin Luther King moved sharply and rapidly to the left in his politics, in his analysis, in his understanding of the way the world works and his understanding of the United States and the United States government. He moved sharply to the left, and we'll talk about that more in some detail because that's important to talk about, while in contrast, we see that Barack Obama was criticized early on because he was seen as he was a community organizer. He had spent a very brief amount of his time, his earlier career as a community, doing some organizing work in Chicago. You know, he was a member of a very progressive Black church in on the south side of Chicago. Jeremiah Wright was the pastor there, an Afrocentric congregation. So we can see maybe some threads of some liberalism in the younger Barack Obama. But over time, he has moved sharply and rapidly, where? Not to the left, but to the right. He is presiding over a reactionary administration that is pulling off some of the most ultra-conservative policies that even the Reagan administration would not have dared to attempt. Even as a candidate, Obama had given praise to Ronald Reagan. So Obama has moved sharply and rapidly to the right, has become more and more conservative, more and more reactionary, more and more regressive in his policies and his politics. Now, his rhetoric may try to play down that angle, but the reality is, gentlemen, that Barack Obama continues to move to the right, whereas Martin Luther King had a consciousness that propelled him to move to the left. And we need to keep that in mind as we move forward. So, again, the contrast between those two men couldn't be more distinct.
Right. And before I make this, you stimulated me to comment on something before I go to our next clip, is, I would say to those folks that are listening, especially, to my, respectfully to my elders, within the black community. You know, I respect for those of you that continue to cling on this notion that, you know, that you have the church fans, you know, that used to have, like, you know, your church fans used to have, you know, the picture of Bobby Kennedy and John F. Kennedy and King, you know, and now it's been replaced with Barack Obama or Barack Obama next to Dr. King and having all this, like, you know, revisionist history paraphernalia throughout your house, you know, whether it's a T-shirt with Obama and King. You know, I asked you this respectfully, out of the interest to the next generation, those younger than yourself, those younger than certainly myself and anyone that's in the studio right now, that younger generation coming up. All right, if you want to cling to the illusion that there is some kind of ideological comparison or philosophical comparison between Barack Obama and Martin Luther King, then you live. You please, I just ask you respectively to continue to exist in that delusional world by yourself or with the rest of the Obamites. Go and run through those, you know, those wheat fields, you know, filled with white liberals, you know, cheering you on and you know, and the Democratic Party and the symbolic donkeys, you know, running around so you can ride them. Live in that delusional world by yourself, you know. Because when you put this stuff out there ad nauseum and try to and don't give any perspective or even trying to verbally compare the two together, Obama and King together, you are doing the younger generation a disservice. You are doing their subsequent struggle. Every generation has its own struggle. And it's the generation right now, you know, it's our, you know, our generation to, it's our, you know, that needs to do the work to try to make the next make it easy, make the struggle for the next generation easier. Just like your struggle and the work that you did in the '60s made it easier for us to have, you know, various tools to engage in this struggle, which, you know, is no laughing matter. Is nothing to be taken softly. This struggle is very serious. It's especially serious because, you know, folks have been blinded by the illusion, you know, with reality TV shows and sports and so forth, that that there is very little struggle that is actually being waged right now, but there's an actual struggle. So I say to you, just please don't do that disservice to this younger generation. They need to know the truth about Dr. King, and I'm not asking you to program them. As an educational practitioner, I think the best way to educate folks is through exposure, through experience. Expose them to, if you want to expose them to 63, fine, but expose them to the entire speech in 63. Expose them also to Dr. King's subsequent speeches and the work that he was doing, Operation Breadbasket, and the work that he did mobilizing in places like Cleveland, and the work that, you know, the SCLC did, and expose, you know, the work that black women did, organizers, that made Dr. King possible, the grassroots, you know, gritty work that those women were doing, you know, around Dr. King to make him, to help, you know, elevate him, you know, expose them to all that stuff. And certainly they're going to get exposed to Obama. He's being exposed every single day, not in the kind of way I'd like him to be exposed, but he's being exposed by the media as, you know, as this guy is like, hey, you know, post-racial and this, that, and the other, this is the man and so forth. And I think that kids who are very bright, far brighter than some of us give them respect for, or give them credit for, I should say, they'll pick it up. They'll pick it up. They'll expose, like, man, you know, you expose them to King's speech in 1967 alone. Like, damn. And then what they know about Obama now, which what they thought about Obama is a good thing, they look at that speech and they say, well, wow, these guys were really different. This guy seemed like he was really against war, just against war. And Obama, whereas I thought it was a good thing, you know, because that's what I was told by mommy and daddy or grandpa and grandma, that going into Libya, you know, we were doing something good, you know, because Obama said so, you know, Dr. King obviously saw a different alternative to war, and saw war as not even a last alternative, as something that should not be an alternative whatsoever. And so just do that, all right? You know, save your delusion for your own, you know, your own nighttime Democratic Party wet dreams. Keep it into your mind and so forth. But don't impose, you know, your false revisionist history on youth. Just give them the whole gambit of who Dr. King was. Let them come to their conclusions. Talk to them about, you know, why he was so fair to the government, why he was not invited anymore after he started speaking out against the Vietnam War, why he was no longer invited to the White House by LBJ, why, you know, all these things, why he was assassinated, you know, the work that he, you know, why he was anti-capitalist. Expose him to the truth. That's it. That's all I'm asking. And in that same vein, as we move forward, a couple of people just brought up Ronald Reagan, and I think it's important. Some of you, you know, elders and even people my age, lived through the 80s. And I was just a child in the 80s. I was just a wee child, but I do remember that it was tough. And it wasn't until I was older that I really learned about how nefarious the President of the United States was, who was the president for the majority of the 80s, and that's Ronald Reagan. How this man was a man, and I just want to give this context. This man was a man that referred to black men as bucks. Bucks, you know, historical reference to black men who were African, who were enslaved. All right, bucks, as they, you know, put them on the platform to be sold, all greased up and butt naked, you know, in linseed oil. Bucks, yeah, those, that big back buck. You know what I'm saying? I want him $250. You know, I can't do my. I'm pretty good with white impersonations, but my white Southern slave master impersonation is a little bit off today, so bear with me. And so he referred to black men as bucks to rally his support. All right, this is Reagan. Reagan said this. Okay, Denver, Colorado. Exhibit B. Reagan refers to black women as welfare queens. Refers to black women as welfare queens in Chicago. Yes, he did. Exhibit C. Reagan was a supporter of the white minority apartheid regime in not just South Africa, but also Zimbabwe. Also Zimbabwe was very, very critical of those in the U.S., especially those in U.S. political power that spoke out against Ian Smith and the repressive white minority regime that was in Rhodesia at the time, which is present-day Zimbabwe. Reagan was very, very much, you know, opposed to that, you know, and in favor of Ian Smith, and felt bad for Ian Smith for some of the shots that he took from people within the U.S. And Reagan, remember this. This is also instructive. Reagan was vetoed by Congress. He was overruled by Congress. Remember, he vetoed what came out of Congress, you know, and Congress only did that because of the grassroots movement, the college students and the organizations and the anti-apartheid struggle in the U.S. that pressured them to move forward with sanctions and divestment from South Africa. And Reagan vetoed it. And then it was subsequently overruled by the Congress because they can do that if they have, you know, a clear majority. But this is Reagan. So I say all that. Why are you talking about Reagan? Well, there's just someone just mentioned. I think it was Tim just mentioned. Oh, Peter just mentioned Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, and how Obama goes out of his way to compare him to Reagan. Obama, a couple years ago, folks, was it 2009 or was it 2010? It was one of those 2 years. And you can Google it. Obama, just Google Obama, you know, op-ed piece in USA Today, Reagan, you know, and it will come up. Obama took out an entire page in the USA Today as President of the United States to genuflect, to grovel, to extol, to praise Ronald Reagan. Yes, Ronald, the white supremacist, Reagan. Yes, Ronald, the devil, Reagan. Yes, that Ronald Reagan. That Ronald Reagan. Yes, the same Ronald Reagan that financed a a clandestine war in Central America, killing tens of thousands of people in Central America by way of the CIA and the Contras that were financed by the U.S. government and through Ronald Reagan's direct oversight. Yes, 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 that Ronald Reagan. So I ask you this, what kind of black man, what kind of human being with any kind of moral compass, what kind of human being that loves humanity, shoot, take away the color, but especially, I mean, when you put it, when you say a black person, I mean, it even carries even more weight, I would say, because, you know, this is an individual that, that caused immense damage to the black community. Ronald Reagan did. And so Obama praises him. So that, that should tell you everything that you need to know about who you are dealing with. This is a man that is not beholden to, let's get out, you know, any kind of, you know, let's get these any kind of delusions of grandeur out of our head that he's beholden to any of the philosophies of Dr. King. He's not beholden to peace. He's not in favor of peace. He accepted the Nobel Peace Prize a couple years ago, and he said and he said that some wars are necessary. So you're getting the Nobel Peace Prize, but some wars are necessary. Some wars are necessary. All right? Enough said. Let's listen to what Dr. King has to say.
A time comes when silence is betrayal. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision. But we must speak. I've chosen to preach about the war today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact that there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. And I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soul is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition. There will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people and hear their broken cry.
And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. We are called to speak for the weak, for the voiceless, for the victims of our nation, and for those it calls enemy. For no document from human hands can make these humans any less our brothers. We are met by a deep but understandable mistrust. To speak for them is to explain this lack of confidence in Western words, and especially their distrust of American intentions now. Now that is little left to build on save bitterness.
The world now demands a maturity of America that we may not be able to achieve. I am as deeply concerned about our own troops there as anything else, for it occurs to me that what we are submitting them to is not simply the brutalizing process that goes on in any war where armies face each other and seek to destroy. We are adding cynicism to the process of death, for they must know after the short period there that none of the things we claim to be fighting for are really involved. And the more sophisticated surely realize that we are on the side of the wealthy and the secure, while we create a hell for the poor. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. This way of settling differences is not just. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours.
Dr. King, as nobody else can speak on that topic, the topic of Dr. King's life, then obviously he can. There's not really much to follow up on that besides you tell me if there's some kind of comparison to be made between the ideologies and philosophies of Dr. King to that of Barack Obama. You tell me that, and I'll add one more thing, because when we talk about Reagan also financed RENAMO and UNITA, you know, in Angola and Mozambique. These are two terrorist organizations that in places like Angola, for instance, you know, captured, you know, the lives of over, you know, a million Angolans. All right, and they had an office. You know, they had a proxy office or a satellite office in Washington, D.C. So, you know, as we move forward, Sankara, you know, you're a student, you know, probably when you were a kid weren't exposed to, you know, this kind of version of Dr. King, which is not, you know, an alternative version. It's the real version of Dr. King. What are you thinking?
No, I just think it's incredible, like the conviction that he spoke with, but also the fact that, you know, this is a whole other side of Dr. King that I can say, just speaking from my personal experience, was never exposed to. Like as you mentioned earlier, like so many times people who are, you know, call themselves supporters of King zeroing on 1963 and I Had a Dream speech, and not even this speech in its entirety, which is really doing not only a disservice to Dr. King, but also to everybody, you know, who stands for what Dr. King stood for.
All right. Tim?
I think that his one quote where he says, "Silence is betrayal," is going to be a quote that outlives him forever, since that must always be applied to the current situation, because in any period of time in history, and including the present moment, there are going to be injustices, there are going to be wars, and as we see right now under the current administration, most of those wars right now are actually being committed by the U.S. government. So when Dr. King said silence is betrayal, that applies just as well today and should be a call to action for anyone that hears those words and studies those words again today, to mobilize into a movement against the very injustices that the U.S. government is committing today and other injustices going on abroad.
Without a doubt. And I want to remind you, and I see a lot of folks that are on right now, if you do want to, no pressure, but if you do want to call in, and chime in and give your thoughts on Dr. King, please feel free to, to give your own personal thoughts on Dr. King, whatever they may be. The number is 347-945-5191. Peter.
Yeah, Solomon, you mentioned allowing the younger generation to find out the real King for themselves rather than to be brainwashed by the King-Obama conglomeration nonsense. So I just wanted for our readers who are interested in doing that, be they young or old or wherever they are in life, some great resources to go and find out for yourself, because that's one of the ways I did it. I found out about the real King and the movement of which he was a part by delving into the history, by delving into his original works and those some works about him by some excellent scholars. So for those that are listening and you have some interest, there's a trilogy, three books by one author that put King in context and give a detailed account of the civil rights movement. The author is Taylor Branch. And the three books, the first book is called Testament of Hope, and it is a compendium of King's speeches and writings, and so you can get right into his own words. You don't have to listen to somebody else's versions of them. You can read King's writing and words for yourself in Testament of Hope. Again, that's by Taylor Branch. The other two books are detailed accounts of King in context of the civil rights movement, and those two books are Parting the Waters, and the third book is At Canaan's Edge. It's a three-volume work on King in the context of the civil rights movement. And obviously there's a great deal of other books, but just a few that I would commend to you. A book by James Cone called Martin and Malcolm and America. It puts Malcolm in dialogue, not with Barack Obama, but with Malcolm X. And it talks about how Malcolm and Martin were inextricably connected to one another through their movement, through their participation in the movement for liberation in this country and internationally. So and James Cone makes the contention in that book that one cannot understand the work of Malcolm X without putting it in conversation with Martin Luther King, and that we can't understand Martin Luther King without putting him in conversation with Malcolm X. So I highly recommend that book. Also another book by Vincent Harding, who knew Martin personally, and it's called Martin Luther King, The Inconvenient Hero. Again, Vincent Harding. And then a book by a scholar that, Solomon, I know you're not a big fan of, but he did put out an excellent book on King. Michael Eric Dyson put out a book called I May Not Get There With You, The True Martin Luther King. And he does an excellent job of exposing the lies that we're touching on today, and then uncovering the real Martin Luther King. And then the last book that I want to commend to our listeners is called An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, An Act of State. That's by William Pepper, just like Dr. Pepper. William Pepper, who was also a friend and confidant of Martin Luther King and a legal scholar, and he lays out the facts of how Martin Luther King was executed by the United States government. So that is certainly an invaluable resource in understanding how Martin was an enemy of the powers that be, starting with his position on the Vietnam War that we just listened to some excerpts of some speeches from, and which eventually led to his ultimate demise. An Act of State by William Pepper lays out the facts in the case against the United States government for the murder of Martin Luther King. So those are just a few of the works that you can buy. And also online, you can go to stanford.edu to the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute if you want to go online and do some research. That's at stanford.edu. So those are some great resources for folks to get for themselves, to get into the very words of King himself and to some of his friends and colleagues and high-powered scholars who have studied King and are willing to talk about the real Martin Luther King.
Yeah, definitely. And the one book that I would add that I think it would be have to be one of the first books, if not the first book, that people who are not familiar with Dr. King that you get a hold of is a book by Dr. King himself, Where Do We Go From Here, Community or Chaos? I learned more about King through that one book than any other book that I've read. I mean, that book right there, Where Do We Go From Here, Community or Chaos, by Dr. Martin Luther King himself, is very, 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 very powerful, educational, instructive on his life, his thoughts, you know, on a range of things. And you know, once again, just Where Do We Go From Here, Community or Chaos, by, you know, the man himself, Dr. Martin Luther King, the man who is compared to this man. So if I can put my you know, my lawyer hat on, once again, this would be Exhibit D, for those of you that want to continue to compare King to and here's the thing. The reason why we're going at certain length to expose the blatant lie of comparing King to X is because it is King to Obama, King to Obama, is that, number one, as an African, as a black man, you are not gonna rewrite my people's history and legacy. You're simply not on my watch, and I know not on a lot of other Africans' watch as well. And so, as an African, you are not going to rewrite our legacy and the legacy of those within our community who literally gave their blood, you know, for liberation. And so you're just not going to do that. And people are trying to do that. They're actively trying to do that. Anytime you obfuscate and marginalize and leave out and omit various aspects of King's life, and then go ahead and reconfigure that and place it, you know, perpendicular to that of Obama, you're disingenuous at best. But beyond that, I've got a whole lot of other choice words. But since this is a PG-13 show, or actually this is an R-rated show, I'm not going to take it to an X-rated show, you know, in language-wise, and call you what I really want to call you, because this is what you're doing every time that you refer to him. This is the man that you're trying to compare him to. This is the revisionist history that you're trying to compare him to. You might as well, if you're going to compare Dr. King to Obama, you might as well, I mean, shit, you know, since I just said it's R-rated show, shit, while you're at it, just compare Dr. King to friggin', you know, Godzilla. Compare him to Freddy Krueger. Compare him to Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees, every other serial killer, sociopath that you can think of. Compare him to those individuals as well. You might as well, all right? You still be lying, but you might as well. And this is why I detest that comparison to Obama.
On Capitol Hill, resistance to U.S. militarism has all but collapsed, and the Republican majority in the U.S. House has not even arrived yet. With no opposition whatsoever in the Senate and only 48 nay votes in the House, the Congress last week passed the biggest military budget since the end of World War II. Only 42 Democrats, including just 12 members of the Congressional Black Caucus, dared to defy their warmongering president and compliant House leadership. From the moment that Barack Obama won the Democratic nomination, we at Black Agenda Report have been predicting that he would become the most pro-war president in modern American history. Forget about Obama's phony rhetoric. The proof is in the numbers. The military budget firmly cements Barack Obama's place as the biggest pro-war president in two generations. Today, the United States, although it is the world's only superpower, spends almost as much as all of the rest of the world's militaries combined. The U.S. defense authorization for 2011 is $725 billion. China, with the second most expensive military machine on the planet, spends less than $80 billion a year. If Barack Obama lasts for 8 years in office, he is on track to spend $5 trillion on the Pentagon, significantly more than George Bush, who in turn spent a lot more than Ronald Reagan. But, as they say on the TV commercials, that's not all. The defense budget doesn't include expenditures for Homeland Security, Veterans Affairs, nuclear weapons work at the Department of Energy, military aid to other countries through the Department of State, NASA space programs that are really military projects, the military retirement fund run out of the Department of Treasury, and the interest payments on past military expenditures that were financed by debt. Inclusion of those hidden costs of war would bring military-related spending to well over $1 trillion a year and rising all the time. In real dollars, the U.S. is spending far more on the military than at any time during the Cold War, when there was another superpower in competition, and more than President Lyndon Johnson spent at the height of the Vietnam War. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. broke with LBJ over that war, in part because he knew, in Dr. King's words, that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continue to draw men and skills and money like some demonic, destructive suction tube. Under the first black president, that military suction tube is far bigger and more destructive than in Dr. King's day, while the economic crisis is arguably much worse, threatening the very viability of black America as a national community. Yet only 12 black members of Congress can bring themselves to vote against Obama's wars. And the black misleadership class in general demands that African Americans sacrifice their own economic survival interests to Barack Obama's political interests. Obama is not merely a continuation of the Bush administration's war policies. He has accelerated the descent into a war economy. That is nothing for any black person to be proud about. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And for those that, as Peter alluded to in the beginning of the show, think that Dr. King was this, you know, cute, fuzzy guy, you know, I don't want to be a cute, fuzzy guy, you know. And so I say that, you know, in a good way, that he was not a cute, fuzzy guy. You know, cute, fuzzy guys and cute, fuzzy gals, cute, fuzzy men, cute, fuzzy women, don't make good community leaders. Don't make good freedom fighters. Freedom fighters have to have an edge to them. Have to have an edge and have to have a willingness to speak out in the face of injustice, even when it is vastly unpopular to do so, and to be willing to not fit in, to be willing to be one of those that travels on that road that is seldom traveled by the masses, seldom traveled by the multitude. And so it was Dr. King that, as we know, that he had drafted a letter to his father that was, you know, that was exposed after his death. And within his letter to his father, he said that he was preparing a speech, his next speech after the speech that he gave to those striking sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee, his next speech. Now, we don't know what was in the body of that speech, but we can kind of just, you know, make our own summations and assumptions you know, educated guesses, our own hypotheses in terms of what would have been, you know, contained within that speech simply by looking at the name. The name of his next speech was entitled Why America May Go to Hell. I repeat, Why America May Go to Hell. I am not making this up. Why America May Go to Hell. Very strong words coming from a pastor. Very strong words coming from a pastor. Very strong words coming from an individual that also says, you know, any nation that spends more on military than it does on programs of social uplift is headed towards its spiritual death, its spiritual doom. Yeah, those are strong words. It was a strong times, and we're in the midst of those strong times now, aren't we, Peter Fowler?
We definitely are, Solomon. And you know, the fact that Martin Luther King was a pastor and was a Baptist preacher is another way that his memory is besmirched, and another reason why he is often misportrayed as a, you know, warm and fuzzy character who just wanted everybody to get along and just wanted wanted peace. But, you know, he was very much like what Peter Tosh says, I don't want no peace, I want equal rights and justice. And to speak about a theology of Martin Luther King, I would identify with something that another scholar, a Kingian scholar, David Luban, said. He said the real theology required by King was not a biblical or even Socratic doctrine of conscience, but rather an understanding of the essentially redemptive character of political action itself. All right? The essentially redemptive character of political action itself. And when we talk about redemption, King does not use, and I defy you to read through his speeches and even his sermons when he spoke from church pulpits, to find the orthodox language of traditional Christianity in terms of redemption of the individual soul. He doesn't use that language. He doesn't use those metaphors. Dr. King uses the metaphors and the language and even the theology, if I may, of collective redemption in this world right now, or what I call temporal redemption. Dr. King didn't talk about a pie in the sky when we die, kind of going to heaven where everything will be fine by and by. But he talked about a beloved community here on earth, and he believed that we have the resources to bring that about. He knew that the United States had the material and the human resources to bring that about. And so that's why he spoke out against it, because he recognized the fact that as he spoke with people around the country, especially in the northern ghettos and in the western big cities like Los Angeles and Watts, he realized and he recognized that the United States was squandering its material and its human resources in wars of aggression around the planet. And like you mentioned, it's even more relevant today because the war machine, as Glenn Ford pointed out, is multiple times larger than it was in the 1960s. And Barack Obama oversees the most murderous and odious purveyor of violence on the planet that Dr. King recognized. But it is exponentially larger today than it was in 1968. So, you know, these things are relevant, and King's analysis is super relevant. We need to understand, Solomon, that his analysis, maybe in 1955, was a race-based analysis because of the movement that he was involved with in Montgomery and in the South immediately following the Montgomery bus boycott. But as he evolved and as he matured politically, his analysis became increasingly class-based, not only class-based, but international in scope, going all the way back to the late 50s when he was actually in Ghana when Kwame Nkrumah was sworn in as the first prime minister of a free and sovereign Ghana, when it was no longer the Gold Coast, a colony of Britain, but became a free and sovereign state. Martin Luther King was there, and he extolled the international connection and the need for international solidarity, and he saw the same thing in the war on the Vietnamese people. He was calling for international solidarity on class-based lines. He was calling for a poor people's campaign in 1968. He was preparing a speech or a sermon entitled Why America May Go to Hell, and he was preparing to march behind the impetus that drove that speech. He was preparing the Poor People's Campaign to go and shut down Washington. And he says in his own words, we're going to shut down the Pentagon if that's doable. Now, imagine the threat of a massive march of poor people, especially people of color, marching on Washington and on the Pentagon to literally shut down their daily operations, not in a violent way. Okay, that's the one thing he took away from the uprisings of the 60s, that those internal uprisings were tearing down the very infrastructure that people depended upon, and were leaving many of those poor people dead. But he's talking about massive nonviolent resistance to literally shut down the federal government and to shut down the Pentagon, the War Department. So we see why Martin Luther King had to be taken out, why he was the number one threat to the United States government, because he was about to mobilize people against the United States government, and he was doing it on an internationally in scope. So, you know, these lessons of the real Martin Luther King Jr. are just as valuable, if not more so, to us today, because apparently we haven't learned anything from him. And obviously that's because his legacy and his memory has been besmirched and has been edited and redacted. But certainly, Solomon, certainly Sankara, certainly Tim, we need to learn from the real Martin Luther King and apply not just his ethics here at home, but his ethics in terms of an international community, including foreign policy and domestic policy and all those things that he encompassed.
So, thank you. So, Sankara, you being a student and, you know, as Peter made his clarion call, you know, loud and, you know, and effulgent, you know, for all of us to hear, and I couldn't agree more. Sankara, you being a student, you know, being someone that is solutions oriented, you know, you're a college student, you're a senior, you know, about to, you know, embark on, you know, a life of where you know, a professional career within something, but you're right now a college student. What, you know, because obviously in most college classes, you're not getting this, you're not even getting this kind of information. It's just simply not disseminated in most university classrooms from coast to coast, you know, for a reason. So I ask you, what can you do and what do you plan on doing, you know, in terms of engaging, you know, your peers and your comrades, right, you know, on, you know, the campus that you go to school and beyond? Like, what do you plan on doing, you know, when these discussions, you know, come up, or even, you know, even better yet, that you bring up these discussions, you know, bring these up, you know, bring that, you know, be that an annoying dude, like, ah, damn, that Sankara again, fuck, man, he's going to bring up some social issue shit again. But that means you're doing your job, because, you know, when you're saying that, for every nitwit that will say that about you, you know, there's at least one other person that appreciates that information. So what do you plan on doing, and how do you plan on, you know, on discussing, you know, King?
Well, basically just continuing with the type of work that we're doing right here at Your World News, which is, I'm sure, opening a lot of people's eyes and ears up to a narrative that they have not been exposed to. And yeah, I was kind of chuckling as you were saying that, because I've kind of, and I think Tim can, you know, pretty much say the same thing, but we've kind of become those, you know, annoying dudes that, you know, that people don't want to really talk about politics or anything, you know, conscious around, because, you know, we're always, you know, throwing our two cents. But I think that, you know, with the type of work we're doing here, the radio shows, but also forums that we'll be organizing throughout the year, you know, it's just one of some of the ways that we can kind of shed light on the truths that a lot of people aren't being exposed to. Because I think that in many cases it's just a matter of you know, ignorance, not so much their unwillingness to listen, but just the simple fact that they have not been exposed to this, you know, type of you know, alternative perspective. So yeah, like I said, like we have some big plans for this year, and yeah, I'm just gonna continue, you know, to do what I do, which is you know, educate people and invite them to come, and you know, even possibly help participate in you know, shows like this. So
yeah, I couldn't agree more, and I could say, you know, observing, you know, the work that you've done, you know, I'm quite certain that as Dr. King and the like, you know, look down upon us from the heavens, you know, our ancestors, you know, and especially our freedom fighter ancestors, you know, the Kings and the Ida B. Wells's and the Malcolm X's and you know, the Kwame Ture's and the Fannie Lou Hamer's, and go on and on and on for days. You know, they're smiling upon that work because they understand, you know, how grave things are today in terms of the information war that's going on, and there's this mass campaign of disinformation that's out there, and that, you know, your work, you know, doing that work, as you said, that speaks volumes you know, for itself, in and of itself, that you know, your work is like a bullhorn, and you know, and that your work basically anchors your words. You know, any words that you have about Malcolm X or Martin Luther King, that solidifies it. Because sometimes when you have people, you know, they come in and give speeches on college campuses, and you know, they couldn't wait to get off campus after their speech is done. They get their quick paycheck and they're gone. And, you know, not within their speeches do they talk about work that they're actually doing. You know, far and few between are people that are invited on college campuses that are actually doing some work outside the cozy confines of their offices, you know, their milieus of academia. You know, so they're not talking about organizing. But those speakers that really, really move people, whether they're speakers that are holding forth on 7th Street or holding forth on 125th Street in Harlem, you know, or wherever it is, you know what I'm saying, that they may be holding forth, or if it's you know at an organizational function, those ones that have the most resounding impact upon people are the ones that within their speech they're able to speak and articulate work that they have a history of doing, work that they have a history of doing. You want to be known for your history. You know what I'm saying? The work that you're work that you're doing. That's what you want to be known for. Like, damn, yo, that dude moves me with his words. But yo, on top of it, this dude is talking about his actual experiences out in the community, out in the street, working amongst the people, working with the lumpen proletariat, you know, and those folks and the oppressed, you know, and the marginalized. That's you know, so you know, keep that work up. Tim, you're from Switzerland. You know, what do you do when you go back to Switzerland? When you go back to you know, Western Europe, and folks there probably have even less of an idea of who Dr. King is. You know, what do you tell you know folks within that vastly, vastly, vastly predominantly white nation that you come from?
Well, first of all, I mean, obviously referring to Dr. King. There's a lot of things that people don't know, but just making people realize that they do not live in a bubble. Like many people in Switzerland assume that, you know, they're just a self-sufficient country that's not really dependent on anyone else that practices neutrality and, you know, doesn't have any blood on their hands, when in reality, so many of the resources that Swiss society is built upon and that compose its wealth have been stolen from the continent of Africa through imperialism, through war, and through bloodshed. Even if those troops were not Swiss troops, and even if it was not orchestrated by the Swiss, they benefit from that very parasitic and exploitative nature of capitalism that Switzerland takes part in. So when Martin Luther King talks about, you know, silence is betrayal, I have yet to see Switzerland take a strong stance on U.S. foreign policy and the lives that the U.S. government is taking. So Switzerland is very much complicit with those injustices. And when I go back and I try to expose that to people and make them realize that every single one of us has a stance to take, and every single one of us cannot remain silent on these issues, because if we do, then we are allowing them to continue to happen.
That's right. And, you know, I want to dedicate, you know, I don't know, Peter, you may have, may not heard this, but, you know, since, you know, I'll say it, I'm a hip-hop head, and, you know, I'm going to speak for myself. You know, I want to take a brief interlude, and then we'll finish the So Strong, but I couldn't think of a better song right now, since there's been so much talk about one of Barack Obama's idols. I mean, I think it's just fair. I mean, for us to give tribute to one of his idols, you know, and you know, I'm gonna put my, you know, not my olive branch out there, but my my little stinky little twig out there. This is dedicated to Barack Obama's idol. This is Killer Mike with a song simply known as Reagan.
government has a firm policy not to capitulate to terrorist demands, that no concessions policy remains in force. In spite of the wildly speculative and false stories about arms for hostages and alleged ransom payments, we did not, repeat, did not trade weapons or anything else for hostages.
The ballot of the bullet, freedom up from bullshit. Will we ever do it bigger? Just keep settling for little shit. We brag on having bread, but none of us are bakers. We all talk having greens, but none of us on acres. If none of us on acres, and none of us grow wheat, then who will feed our people when our people need to eat? So it seems our people starve from lack of understanding, cause all we seem to give them is some ballin' and some dancing. And some talking about our car and imaginary mansion. We should be indicted for bullshit we inciting. Children deaf and pretending it's exciting. We are advertisements for agony and pain. We exploit the youth, we tell them to join the gang. We tell them dope stories, introduce them to the gang. Just like our love of North introduced us to cocaine in the 80s when them bricks came on military planes.
A few months ago, I told the American people I did not trade arms for hostages. My heart and my best intentions still tell me that's true, but the facts and the evidence tell me it is not.
The end of the Reagan era, I'm like Lemma 12, old enough to understand that shit had changed forever. They declared a war on drugs, like a war on terror, but what it really did was let the police terrorize whoever. But mostly black boys, but they would call us niggas, and lay us on our belly while they fingers on their triggers. They boots was on our head, they dolls was on our crotches, and they would beat us up if we had diamonds on our watches. And they would take our drugs and monies as they pick our pockets. I guess that that's the privilege of policing for some profit. But thanks to Reaganomics, prison turned to profit. Cause free labor's the cornerstone of U.S. economics. Cause slavery was abolished, unless you are in prison. You think I ambush attend and read the 13th Amendment. Involuntary servitude and slavery get prohibited. That's why they giving drug offenders time in double digits. Ronald Reagan was an actor, not at all a factor. Just an employee of the country's real master. Just like the Bushes, Clinton and Obama. Just another talking head telling lies on teleprompters. If you don't believe the spirit, then argue with his logic. Why did Reagan and Obama both go after Gaddafi? We invading sovereign soil, going after oil. Taking countries is a hobby, paid for by the oil lobby. Same as in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I'm a dinner jar, say they coming for Iran. They only love the rich and how they load the pole. If I say any more, they might be at my door. Who the fuck is that? Staring in my window, doing that surveillance on Mr. Michael Rinder. I'm dropping off the grid before they pump the lead. I leave you with a word, I'm glad Reagan dead.
Speaks for itself, man. He brings up the fact, that Obama and Reagan, you know, both, you know, bombed Libya. Both bombed Libya. And, you know, talks about how, you know, Reagan, you know, really expanded, you know, and really kicked off, I should say, kicked off the whole prison industrial complex, you know, with his war, you know, on drugs, war on crime, you know, he took it to another level. Yeah, Nixon mentioned it, but Reagan really should get credit for building that up, you know, and so, man, that was Killer Mike, you know, just simply known as Reagan. That's the kind of hip hop we play on this show. That's the hip hop that I support, that I lecture about. That's what it's about, and there's a reason why you've never heard that song. Can you imagine? Imagine if that song and songs like that were played on regular rotation 3 and 4 and 6 times a day in the same manner that, you know, Lil Wayne and Young Jeezy's, you know, psychologically destructive songs are played 6 and 7 times a day, you know, on Clear Channel, Viacom, Cumulus, all these different, you know, media outlets on their stations day in and day out, man. Can you imagine? Yes. We know the folks that control the media, yes, they can imagine if you can't imagine, and they can imagine what kind of impact that would have, and that's why they don't play that kind of music. That's why they don't play that kind of music. It's very instructive. It's educational. It is revolutionary. It is mobilizing. It's galvanizing. That is the kind of music that, quite frankly, inspired, you know, little old Solomon, you know, way back yonder, you know, when I was, you know, 12, 13, 14 years of age, you know, with the Public Enemies and the KRS-One's and the Poor Righteous Teachers and Queen Latifah's and so forth and so forth. So, Peter, I think you dig that song. You like that song?
Oh, of course, bro. I like the music. I like the lyrics. I like the message. I like what he's talking about, you know, and like you mentioned, the roots of hip hop, you know, they talk about that. The roots of hip hop go back to, you know, as you talk about in your lectures, you know, as a culture, the cultural phenomenon is about having fun and it's about fellowship and it's about community. And when you're in that context with that concept of community, you know, it can't be helped to recognize and then develop a need to articulate the harsh structural realities in which one finds oneself. You know, when the realities around you are desperate, when the structural realities only demonstrate that there's, you know, that there's poverty and violence around you, and then a further analysis demonstrates that there is a structural reason for it, that those things are built into the system. You know, that makes hip hop a real, real powerful tool. And it's also, and I'm not telling you anything, you're the expert on it, but it's also why hip-hop has been co-opted by the mainstream media, the mainstream culture makers. And so that's why the Lil Waynes are heard every day, all day long, where the guys, you know, the artists that you mentioned, and with conscious music, they're not being played. So we understand that. We understand the role of culture and the role of hip hop, and we, you know, we should embrace those things. There's no question about it. And so let's talk about a little bit of a structural analysis, because those are some of the things that's going on in that music. You know, there's a structural analysis going on there. It's a very creative way. It's not a political scientist doing it. All right, and that's what's so brilliant about using culture as a means of political and structural analysis, and a means to articulate the angst and the indignation that comes up out of that. But we see what we see with Martin Luther King, to get back to the man of the hour, is that King was engaged in a structural analysis, and as I mentioned earlier, he moved away from a purely race-based or color-based analysis of inequality in the United States and around the world to a hybrid of a race and class-based analysis. So he and Malcolm X are very much on the same page at the zenith of their respective careers. And you know, I mentioned earlier what Martin was moving toward was that Poor People's Campaign. Now, the Poor People's Campaign was not the termination of his program, was not the end of the movement, but rather that was going to be the beginning. The beginning of what? Well, that's what we need to ask if we are to understand why Martin Luther King was seen as the most dangerous man in America, in the words of J. Edgar Hoover, and as a lethal troublemaker, in the words of then-Congressman Jesse Helms. But he was, in fact, a troublemaker from the perspective of the halls of power, the Pentagon, the White House, the American Congress, Wall Street, certainly. And it's because his ultimate objective was to transform the structural realities of the United States of America. And what did he mean by that? Was this just some vague notion? Was this just some, you know, pipe dream? No, Martin Luther King had a specific roadmap in terms of where he wanted to go and what he wanted to see manifest itself in the United States. Martin Luther King. Now, this is for a lot of people. This is going to be this is a bomb that I'm about to drop. For a lot of people, they've never heard this concept. But Martin Luther King believed that the United States needed to move towards being a socialistic society. All right, Martin Luther King was moving towards embracing socialism. He was not a Marxist. He never studied Marx. He was familiar with Marx because he was a brilliant man. He was well-studied. He was well-read, held a PhD from Boston University. But he was moving towards embracing socialism in its multifaceted manifestation. Now, he couldn't do this publicly, and he never did do it publicly. In fact, you know, he's on record as saying to some of his confidants, all right, turn the tape recorder off. And then he would go on and talk about how he wanted to bring about a restructuring of American society along socialist terms. He called it democratic socialism. Mm-hmm. But that's where Martin was in 1967 and in 1968 and where he was going. That was his trajectory. And so we can see clearly why he was such an enemy of the state. And that brings even into even sharper relief, I believe, the contrast between Martin Luther King and Barack Obama. We see Martin Luther King wanting to restructure society for a massive and equitable redistribution of wealth and resources for the poorest and the most oppressed of society, as opposed to Barack Obama overseeing a transfer of wealth to the tune of untold trillions. We still don't know what the final dollar amount of these bank bailouts are going to be. Obviously, they were initiated by George Bush Jr., but they were followed up by the Obama administration in 2008, and the bailouts continue. This was basically an open door and a blank check, and Barack Obama has been overseeing that for the last 5 years. And Barack Obama, as Glenn Ford pointed out in the clip, that he is overseeing the most indescribable military budget in the history of the planet. So again, the contrast between King and Obama couldn't be more clear in terms of their trajectory and their analysis of the economics and the economic imperatives of the people for whom they speak and the people for whom they strive to serve. Martin Luther King strove to serve the underclass, the oppressed, the wretched of the earth, where Barack Obama obviously is being controlled by and is serving the elite and the moneyed classes of the United States.
Right. Sankar, I thank you for that, Peter. Sankar, I want to ask you this question. It's a quick two-minute clip of Dr. King, a soundbite that obviously these white liberals and so forth won't want you to hear. But you were somebody who changed your government name, to Sankar. Not only are you very African centered, and that's why you restored, what people call you to your African roots. Did you do that? But you also speak fluent Kiswahili. You plan on going back home to do work there. But then amidst all of that, you you're a Pan-African and your work speaks to Pan-Africanism. So I want to play this clip, to folks that don't think that Dr. King was in touch with his race and who he was as an African. I want to play this right here, and I want to get your first take from that.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, He must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
Sankara.
Yeah, wow, that was a crazy speech by Dr. King. And one of the things that really, one of the words that he said that really sticks with me is the idea of emancipation. As Solomon mentioned, you know, I changed my name in 2011, and that was a part of my emancipation process. Not the final step by any stretch of the imagination, but just a part of me, just embracing, you know, being not just black but African. So like I said, I think that's a great soundbite that kind of, you know, captures, you know, my sentiments and the sentiments of I think all Pan Africanists alike.
Definitely. Now I want to just go around and get folks' last comments as we, you know, we're running low on time, but just get your last comments, you know, on the show and moving forward, because the show, you know, our shows are simply, you know, as we look at them, it's just a point of departure, a platform, a springboard into the continuation of work that Dr. King and so many others, you know, set forth, and so many that are folks that are doing that kind of work today. So, we'll start we'll start with you, Sankara, Tim, and then Peter, and then I'll finish it with a little medley.
Well, I'd like to say, first and foremost, thank you for bringing me on the show. Plan to doing a lot more work, being a lot more active, in this capacity, but also as a community activist as well. One of the things that I took from this show was just that one of the key, what I feel like is one of the key, components to our, you know, liberation, which is activism, but only in a real, tangible sense, community activism, which is something that I plan on improving upon, you know, for 2013. And, I just want to, like I said, thank you for bringing me on the show. This is a lot of food for thought. I plan on doing some research, some of those books that the brother mentioned. But also, like I said, just ready to get my hands dirty with some community-based work. And, if any of you guys are listening and you're interested, you know where to find us. Solomon can connect you with us. And, that's my bit.
Thank you. Thank you. And, you know, you're part of Your World News, so no need to thank us. You're a part of the family. Tim?
I think that this show really can bring us to focus on the triplets that Martin Luther King was talking about: racism, excessive materialism, and the military-industrial complex, and see what we can do to fight those very things that Martin Luther King was fighting for, or against, I should say, during his lifetime, and how we can do everything in our power to ensure a more socialist society in the U.S., to attack and destroy institutional racism, and to ensure that none of our tax dollars go to the annihilation of people in far-off places that are no different from our brothers and sisters right here in this country, and to continue Martin Luther King's legacy in that way, and not let him be assassinated as is so often attempted by the corporate media and even the president today.
Thank you. Peter?
Just a couple of words from Dr. King himself. He said the movement must address itself to the question of restructuring the whole American society, raising questions about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth, and questioning the capitalist economy. So that work is obviously not done. Dr. King was ruthlessly murdered. His movement was crushed out by the U.S. government, and that work is not done. For those of us that embrace Dr. King, that love Dr. King, we fall heir to his legacy and to his work. So we need to not just remember him one day a year or a few days in January and sing We Shall Overcome or take a holiday on the third Monday of January, but we need to engage in that work and to make real the dream. It
right.
is incumbent upon us to make Martin Luther King relevant for the 21st century.
That's right. That's right. And you've been listening to Your World News. You know, we have a couple of exciting shows coming up in the very, very near future, you know, looking to expand upon the work that we did with the Police Brutality and Institutional Racism National Forum in the works of trying to prepare a national forum on mass incarceration and modern-day slavery, you know, and having folks on from Students Against Mass Incarceration and other folks that are doing work around mobilizing around that issue. Have a very important show coming up about President's Day as we move towards February, and folks will be honoring those presidents, you know, the slave-owning presidents, some of them that are honored on that day, and giving our take on some of America's, you know, past presidents and present presidents. For that matter, you know, for a President's Day special. And then, I have something that really I'm working on diligently to put together a show that deconstructs the nefarious role that in detail between hip-hop and the corporate media and outline, you know, the history of hip-hop in a lecture that I hope gets, you know, spread all over the place, you know, to youth so they can really delve into the real roots of hip-hop and also understand media literacy a lot better. So stay tuned to Your World News. Keep visiting us at yourworldnews.org. This is Dr. King in his last speech. This is just a minute, and then I have a little surprise for you with the final song, because I think that those people that continue to not just rewrite the history of Dr. King, you know, are social criminals. And some of those folks that are being compared to Dr. King, like President Obama, are war criminals. So we'll have a song called Real Criminals by my comrades, good friends, Pei Shear, you know. So here we go with Dr. King. Thank you for joining us on Your World News.
We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. Oh, tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Kills me, the law is minimal.